House of Representatives assembled here for the first regular session is hereby called to order.
It's day one for the state legislature. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 18th of January. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Delta bison range a little too free for some.
Those animals are going to be forced to go looking for forage for rangeland elsewhere, and they're going to get bounced over to other parts of the farming community.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. When you file online for your PFD, you can donate to any of 40 Alaska organizations that provide health care services for those who might otherwise go without. Get more with your PFD when you pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation and Providence Health Services Alaska.
All right. The House of Representatives assembled here for the first regular session of the 27th Legislature is hereby called to order.
This year's legislature got underway today in Juneau as Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell gaveled in the House of Representatives, then the Senate this afternoon. The Alaska Youth Choir helped welcome both the House and Senate back to town, but as soon as members took their oaths of office and went through the formalities of organizing, they all recognized that they have a lot of work to do in the next 90 days. Members noted that the top item of the session will be deciding what to do to increase oil production. So far, only one plan is on the table in bills presented by both Governor Sean Parnell and Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker. The idea of changing the way oil taxes are calculated is gathering support. But there's a question of whether any oil tax change is necessary. Anchorage Democrat Bill Wilkowski, part of the Senate majority, says the administration is starting off in the wrong direction.
It's a very expensive bill. It's going to cost the state roughly $5.5 billion, $6 billion over the next 4 years or so. And there's no guarantees of investment. There's no guarantees of increased jobs in Alaska. So I'm very skeptical of the bill.
A few committees get down to work tomorrow afternoon, but the big push on the major issues will begin tomorrow evening when the governor will deliver his State of the State message to a joint session. A coalition of Alaska Native groups say they plan to file suit against the federal government over its recent designation of critical habitat for polar bears. KBRW's Jake Neer has more.
Arctic Slope Regional Corporation and the North Slope Borough are leading a group of over a dozen Native organizations in a legal fight against critical habitat designation for polar bears. ASRC spokesperson Tara Sweeney says the designation wrongly places the burden of new regulations on the people of the North Slope.
This is a quality of life issue for the people of the North Slope, and the burden of this designation is going to be felt by the people of the North Slope instead of targeting perhaps industries as far away as Ohio who are contributing to climate change. We're being held accountable for something that's happening all across this country and actually all across the circumpolar region.
The coalition of groups planning to join ASRC in its lawsuit includes four regional corporations, the North Slope Borough, the Inupiat community of the Arctic Slope, and six village corporations all located on the North Slope. Officials from these groups sent a letter Monday alerting the Interior Department they intend to sue. The groups say the federal government broke the law when it ignored the concerns of the Alaska Native community and designated more than 187,000 square miles as critical habitat off Alaska's North Slope. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officials say the designation will not change or enhance regulations that already exist under the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act. They say it will simply add closer reviews of projects with federal implications. Fish and Wildlife spokesperson Rosa Meehan says her agency did not break any laws in the process of designating critical habitat for polar bears.
From a process perspective, it was done in a very standard and open process.
It's a process that's well established in public law and case law.
But North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta says he feels local residents and leaders are being left in the dark over the details of the designation.
I still don't feel that anybody really has come up here and answered our questions on just specifically what does this mean for us, instead of just assurances, oh, everything will go on as before, nothing is going to change.
Polar bears were declared threatened under the ESA in 2008. In Barrow, I'm Jake Neer.
It may be time to take the eastern stellar sea lion off the endangered species list. That's according to the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is doing a comprehensive review to decide whether the population is free of threats and healthy enough to warrant the change. Alaska, Washington, and Oregon have petitioned for delisting, which could reduce the regulatory burden on some public and private sector activities. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Stellar sea lions like these make a habit of lazing atop the red and white buoys marking the northern entrance to the Wrangell Narrows and Petersburg's waterfront. NIMFS considers these sea lions part of the Eastern Distinct Population Segment, Eastern DPS for short. According to the agency, the population has increased 3% a year for the past 30 years. A 2008 estimate put the Southeast Alaska population at 14,000 animals. In 2009, NOAA researchers counted more than 7,400 sea lion pups in the five biggest rookeries along the Southeast Alaska coast. That's about 35% more than the last pup count in 2005. This August, the states of Alaska, Oregon, and Washington petitioned the federal government to take this DPS off the endangered species list.
The Eastern Distinct Population Segment of Stellar Sea Lions are no longer threatened with extinction in the foreseeable future, which is the standard for needing to cover a species under the Endangered Species Act.
Alaska Department of Fish and Game Special Assistant Doug Vincent Lang is the state's Endangered Species Coordinator. He wrote Alaska's petition to delist the eastern sea lions.
The population, in our mind, has achieved its recovery goals since it was first listed in 1990, and the threats facing it have been addressed. So it's a success story, the Endangered Species Act, and we ought to celebrate successes by delisting species as much as we have the unfortunate responsibility of putting species on that list when necessary to conserve them.
Even if the animals were delisted, they would still be covered under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. With some exceptions, MMPA generally prohibits the killing of sea lions. But according to Vincent Lang, delisting from the Endangered Species Act will get Alaska out from under what he calls an unnecessary web of regulations that can impede activities like fishing or development. NIMFS has put forward new restrictions on fishing in the Aleutians to protect western stellar sea lions, but the agency's found that the eastern population is doing well enough that delisting may be warranted. NIMFS had already begun a status review of the eastern stocks when it received the state's petitions this summer. That review's continuing. NIMFS Stellar Sea Lion Coordinator Lisa Roderman says it not only looks at current demographics like population health, but it also considers problems that could come up in the future.
You don't want to get on a roller coaster where you protect, you recover, you delist, the threats come back, and you are in a position that, you know, X number of years later you have to relist again. And so we also are looking at the most recent information about threats to determine whether we see anything new in there that would make us believe that if we were to remove the protections of the Act, the status of the population might change in a downward fashion.
NIMFS is currently in the middle of a 60-day public comment period on delisting the eastern sea lions. Roderman says the agency wants to be comprehensive in its review. One of the groups that will be keeping an eye on that review is Oceana. The Ocean Conservation Group has called for increased protections for the western stellars, but Oceana scientist John Warrenchuk in Juneau is more optimistic about the health of the eastern stock.
The eastern stock of stellar sea lions appears to be doing quite well in this region of Southeast Alaska. And if it is warranted that the stock be delisted from the Endangered Species Act, that would be a success of conservation.
The current public comment period closes February 11th. NMFS is required to finish the status review and issue a finding by August 30th. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new novel set in Alaska looks at a crumbling marriage.
You know, a little bit of tragedy is a good thing. I think that understanding that and waking up to it and realizing it a bit more would make us more honest.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
An advisory group has come up with a long-awaited recommendation on how to handle the problem of bison roaming through Delta Junction area farmers' fields. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, it's all about fencing. Lots of it.
Members of the Delta Bison Working Group last week broke an impasse that for more than a year now has kept them from moving ahead on a new plan to manage the state's biggest bison herd. The impasse arose over disagreement on how to keep the bison from trampling on and feeding on crops being cultivated around Delta Junction. Randy Rogers, a wildlife planner with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, says the sticking point was over what types of fencing to build and whether it should contain bison or exclude them.
So the two alternatives really are constructing fences to keep them out of agricultural areas or fences that would prevent the bison from ever accessing agricultural areas.
The group decided against a proposal by members with the Salcha Delta Soil and Water Conservation District to keep bison fenced in on a portion of the Delta Junction bison range and out of farmers' fields while their crops were in the ground. The proposal was considered unworkable and outside of the Fish and Game Department's authority because it's charged by the legislature to manage the bison as a free-ranging species. Instead, the group recommended by a 5-to-1 vote to build fencing, lots of fencing, up to 150 miles of it, according to one proposal. Rogers says the fencing is estimated to cost anywhere from $300,000 to more than $1 million. The group also approved by a 5-to-1 vote a proposal to reduce the Delta herd population. It now numbers around 360, not including the increase from the spring calving season. The proposal would reduce the population to between 275 and 325 animals before the calving season. That's not as much as some agriculture industry backers had wanted, but Rogers says the proposal balances the concerns of one interest group, farmers, with another, hunters.
We did that in part because of concerns about achieving the harvest objective and maintaining the quality of the hunt. So it wasn't just something to reduce agricultural damage.
Hunters have a stake in the management of the Delta herd because of the popularity of the annual bison hunt, Alaska's most popular drawing permit hunt. In recent years, some 10,000 hunters have bought tickets for the annual drawing of around 100 permits to hunt a bison. Hunters have opposed the idea of fencing the bison in and of thinning the herd. Hunters and others point out that bison were introduced to the area in 1928 when the federal government transplanted a herd from Montana. They say the bison were here long before the farmers moved in through the state-subsidized Delta Agricultural Project, launched in the late 1970s when the state was awash in oil money. Delta farmer Ron Caspar, the working group's dissenting vote, says farmers have concerns about whether the proposed fencing can keep the wide-ranging, powerful bison out of farmers' fields where the animals have become accustomed to feeding. Caspar says the farmers badly want a solution to protect the industry and its budding commercial offshoots, like a venture to sell seed potatoes to Asian markets. Caspar, who serves on the Salcha Delta Water Conservation District Board, says farmers don't like the fencing proposal approved in last week's meeting because the bison will simply move on to other areas that are not protected by fences.
It doesn't
solve the big picture problem. Those animals are going to be forced to go looking for forage for rangeland elsewhere, and they're going to get bounced over to other parts of the farming community.
The progress in last week's meeting will help Fish and Game move ahead with its long-awaited Delta Bison Management Plan update. Rogers says the working group's recommendations will be worked into a draft plan that will be presented for public review and comment over the next several months. That input will then be included in a final draft to be presented to the State Board of Game in March of next year. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Sitka is among the communities in southeast Alaska that sees fewer visits from cruise ships than the Inside Passage mainstays of Ketchikan, Juneau, and Skagway. But local officials are hoping to change that. And last week, they asked for the Sitka Assembly's help. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Places like Sitka, Haines, and Hoonah are known in the cruise industry as second-tier ports. Smaller or less accessible communities that cruise ships are less likely to visit. And officials from Sitka, Haines, and Hoonah want that to change. Tanya Ryu is president of the board for the Sitka Convention and Visitors Bureau.
What they're trying to do is put together a comprehensive proposal that they could take to a major cruise line to see if they would make an itinerary that has never been created before that includes exclusively second-tier ports.
The idea is called Backroads Alaska, and representatives of the three southeast communities are hoping to present it in March at the cruise industry's annual trade show in Miami. But before they make the pitch, they want to have something to sweeten the deal.
Because they would be taking a chance on trying something that's really never been tried, and as far as I know, never considered before.
In Sitka, those incentives would apply only to the single ship that visits the second-tier ports exclusively. Ideas include closing down Lincoln Street for part of the day while the ship is in town, and waiving Sitka's port fees for 1 year, again, only for the vessel that's operating on the Backroads itinerary. In Sitka, those fees amount to about $8,000 a year for one vessel.
Obviously, $8,000 in a year to a cruise line isn't a huge amount, but when combined with the other ports as well, it would be a large, you know, an incentive for them to come, and it would just be part of the proposal.
Assembly members, including Mayor Cheryl Westover, expressed support for the plan, but the assembly said there was a little more homework to do first before it officially signed on. Assembly member Tor Christensen asked about bigger ports.
Cruise lines have their own businesses in those towns. Do we really think that we can pull them away from their own profit centers like that? Is this realistic to think we can do that?
Again, Tanya Ryu.
I think if they have the customer base for it and if they could pilot it and not have any loss, it's a possibility. That's my opinion. I could be overly optimistic, but it certainly doesn't hurt to try.
Assemblymember Phyllis Hackett wondered if businesses had been consulted on the idea to make downtown a pedestrian mall when the ship is in town. Ryu said she didn't recall if John Dunlap, the convention and visitor board member who worked most heavily on the plan, had done that consulting. CVB Executive Director Sandy Lorigan acknowledged that in the past, some businesses have expressed opposition to closing off downtown. But Lorigan said since those discussions, cruise ship traffic has decreased, which could change the mindset, especially as merchants browse the 2011 cruise schedule.
It is just so scant. You know, there might be, you know, two large ships in 1 week. It's just like unbelievable how it's going to drop off for next year. Mm-hmm. And I think merchants are starting to notice that we need some funding coming in.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
The state of Alaska will provide emergency funds to Savunga villagers whose homes were damaged by recent power outages. A dramatic storm that wiped out electric transmission lines in late December and early January is being blamed for prolonged power failures that resulted in burst pipes, ruptured sewer lines, and interior flooding in privately owned homes and public buildings. About 150 people had to take shelter in Savunga's school for several days. Governor Sean Parnell has declared the storm a disaster and activated the state's individual assistance program, which is designed to provide financial assistance to individuals or families to meet eligible disaster-related necessary expenses and unmet needs. The maximum amount for the current year is over $15,000.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Rasmussen Foundation is announcing a March 1st deadline to apply for individual artist awards, which provides funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Learn more by participating in one of the informational teleconferences open to the public to be held the week of January 17th. Call 297-2882 or go online at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Investigators continue looking for the reason a diver died last week while collecting sea cucumbers near Metlakatla. The man, whose name has not been released, was working on the 68-foot fishing tender Island Dancer last Wednesday afternoon. Marshall Newberry is with the Coast Guard's Marine Safety Detachment in Ketchikan.
We've looked at all the different local policies for these dive fisheries that are in effect and everything else, and from everything we can tell, the Island Dancer was following the rules and they were being safe. We're not sure what the cause of the accident at this point is.
Another diver was in the water at the same time but was in a different area. Newberry says the other three people on the Wrangell-based Island Dancer saw what happened.
They have communications with the diver. They could hear him breathing. He talked a few times before this happened, and then he surfaced. He surfaced for an unknown reason, kind of came up fast, and they saw him waving his arm, and at the same time, it appeared that he pulled his mask off. And then a few seconds after that, he went back under.
The crew pulled him out of the water using his air hose, but could not revive him. Newberry says the man was diving in less than 60 feet of water. The Coast Guard is testing equipment, and the body will undergo a medical examination. Skelak Lake on the Kenai Peninsula is the setting for a new novel that comes out today. Author David Vann, who spent his early childhood in Alaska, writes about a rapidly disintegrating 30-year marriage in Caribou Island. But Vann says the largest character in the book is really Alaska, because the tragedy that unfolds couldn't happen any other place. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
David Vann wrote the first 50 pages of Caribou Island 14 years ago, but he could never quite figure out how to make it into a novel. Then on a January winter day in 2009, he returned to Skelak Lake looking for some inspiration.
And just saw the whole place again in the middle of winter. So beautiful and really cold. And I think that helped inspire me to start writing it again a couple months after that. And then it was just like riding a freight train. It's 5.5 months and I wrote the whole thing.
Skelak Lake isn't very remote by Alaskan standards, but it feels remote. And Vann says that made it the perfect setting for a crumbling marriage. In the book, the husband, Gary, decides to build a cabin on Caribou Island. His wife, Irene, goes along with the plan, even though Gary has very little idea how to complete the project. He's a classic and headstrong bumbler. And Vann says it's a character trait he knows well.
Each of the characters, I think, in any novel is some part of the novelist. And that reckless kind of dream that Gary has, that he'll build a cabin which will be the shape of a man, that this will be the outward shape of who he is. It'll be his personality made physical in the world, and that he doesn't want anyone else's plans because of that. He just wants to make it happen as if he's the first person to come upon here and the first person to build a cabin. That's just how I feel and how my dad felt. And it doesn't work out well for him, as you might imagine. You know, the cabin ends up looking like a hovel made out of sticks.
To say things don't work out well is a bit of an understatement. At the risk of giving too much away, let's just say the book builds towards a powerful final scene that includes some violence. But Vann would prefer you don't call it gruesome, like I did.
There's a very gruesome scene in this book.
Why do you think? Actually not a gruesome scene in this. That's the funny thing. Everyone talks about it like somehow it tips into horror at the end, but I think everyone needs to learn what horror is and what tragedy is. This is just tragedy. There's nothing gruesome about it, and it's not gross, and it's not described in any detail. We don't all have happy, easy, good lives, and we're not all good. And literature is actually about things that are wrong with people, you know, problems that they have. It's just what it is. So it's really strange. When in Europe, the reviews always understand that. And in America, every single review, they're nice about the book, but they're clearly uncomfortable about the darkness of it.
And it sounds like that makes you a little mad.
Yeah, I think that Americans need to wake up. You know, our lives have a little bit of darkness to them. We're not happy and good, actually. So why are we pretending? I don't get it. You know, there was Palin's TV series on Alaska with little kitten music playing in the background while she says nasty things. And that's like the worst part of Alaska and also of America, like having little kitten music pretending that we're fine when actually we're like seething underneath and deeply tragic and wrong, you know. So, you know, a little bit of tragedy is a good thing. I think that understanding that and waking up to it and realizing it a bit more would make us more honest.
Van knows a lot about personal tragedy. His dad committed suicide when he was 13 years old. His last book of fiction, Legend of a Suicide, explored that dark period in his life. Van says he bases all of his fiction on events in his own family, and Irene's fate in Caribou Island is one of those family stories. Van says she can't save herself from her own tragedy because she can't make sense of the story of her life.
She can't get who she is now to match up with who she was 5 years ago or 30 years ago. She can't get how she spent her life to be okay. She can't make a story out of that. And I really think that we all desperately need that in real life, that we need to be able to make a story that makes sense of our lives, that connects who we are now to who we were at all those previous times. And that when we can't do that, when we stop being able to make a story that makes sense and that we're okay with, that we're in trouble.
The novel isn't all dark and bleak, though. Van says he populated the storyline with lighter characters who could offer comic relief and explore other aspects of Alaskan life. One young character named Carl spends a day on a slime line at a fish processing plant. Actually, he can't even make it a full day, which is similar to the experience Van had researching the book.
Actually, I think I only lasted like 5 hours or something in the morning. My hands really hurt. It's hard work. You know, it's so cold, even through the triple gloves on the slime line, and I felt like I had enough material.
Van also took hikes in the area and went out on a commercial fishing boat in an effort to get all the details right. He says Alaska is such a beautiful place, he wanted to describe it as accurately as possible. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jake Neer in Barrow, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Tim Ellis in Delta, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. And by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Spring semester starts January 20th. Information at distance.uaf.edu.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD and consider sharing a portion with your favorite charity through Pick, Click, Give. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Help manage subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide critical advice to the Federal Subsistence Board on the management of subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing on federal public lands. The deadline to apply is February 18th. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.